Acorns are dropping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine.
Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 118, hashtag Me Made May. Sunday, May 8th, 2016. I'm your host, Sarah. You can find me on social media as Sarah Pomegranate. The Yarns at Yin Hu podcast has a Facebook page, and it's available on iTunes. This week's episode includes the following segments: the back porch, the front porch, ever-expanding skill set, and so forth. It is a very cool and dreary morning here in Delaware Water Gap, Pennsylvania. We've had a rather cool spring. Initially, it was dry, but the past week has been very cool and rainy. The days are long and the light is long, so things are still blooming and greening up, but it hasn't felt like warm spring weather at all. The ducks on the creek below Yin Hu have been very active and very noisy. They're some of my favorite visitors to the low-lying area behind the house. And we have mallards, of course, and we have common merganser, which are quite a large variety of duck. The male is very striking with a black and white body, and the female has a copper-colored spiky mohawk on top of her head. And I've also seen quite a few wood ducks this year. Wood ducks are a beautiful but very small and very cautious type of duck. They can be elusive, and if they hear any disruptive noises, they will fly immediately. And the other day I saw three males swimming around in the large pool on the creek. We are having some major bridge construction, and the traffic near our home has slowed considerably because it's no longer a thoroughfare from one main road to another. Everything has quieted down, and I think over the next few months, when this bridge work is being completed, we might be treated to more and more wildlife sightings. So I think that's something really to look forward to. And I always like to sit on the porch and enjoy the ducks. The back porch. Over the past few weeks, I have completed a few knitting projects. One of them is a pair of socks that I've had on the needles for quite a while. It's been one of my goals for the year to find a preferred pattern and method for knitting socks. I've been trying a lot of different things. On this pair, I used double pointed needles, or DPNs, in US size 0. These are carbons needles, and I really, really like them. I knit a toe-up sock with quite a bit of ribbing. There's ribbing on the top of the foot and ribbing all the way up the cuff. It has a tubular bind-off, and I knit my first Fish Lips Kiss heel. These socks fit better than any socks I've knit so far, and they were very comfortable to knit. I felt like I wasn't avoiding them. I was glad to have socks on the go in my bag and pull them out and work on them. So I'm approaching a preferred sock, and this is my third pair for the year, and May has just begun. So I feel pretty good about that. I have another pair of socks cast on already, which I'll talk about in the next segment. And then I have some other sock tools and sock methods that I would like to try. My friend Mary Beth swears by 9-inch circular needles. I have very, very large hands, and so I had a little bit of difficulty manipulating them, especially when there was a ribbing or a pattern. But yesterday at the Maryland Sheep and Wool Festival, Janice let me knit a few stitches on a stockinette sock that she was working on. She had 9-inch circulars and they had wooden tips. And I thought that experience was pretty comfortable. So those may be in my future, but I think they're best suited to a pretty plain stockinette sock. I really like the toe-up method, and I enjoy the tubular bind-off, which is a really nice stretchy bind-off and gives a really smooth finish on the top of the sock, more like a commercial sock. I've also completed, over the past week or so, Bonnie. Bonnie is a beautiful sleeveless tank with a lace inset at the neck. The design is by Tin Can Knits, and this pattern was a gift from Fernanda. I've been wanting to knit it a long time. I had it at the top of my queue, and Fernanda gave me the gift of the pattern. I knit this in a whisper lace. I'm not sure of the exact color, but it's like a smoky plum color, a color that I really love and use almost as a neutral in my wardrobe. And this is a merino silk blend. It's 440 yards to 100 grams, so it isn't exactly a lace weight, but it's very soft, and the fabric doesn't have a lot of body or structure to it, so it's incredibly drapey, and I thought it would be nice for this top. I used US size 4 needles and knit a size medium because I wanted a top to have no ease to just a little bit of ease. I began with a ribbed hem instead of a rolled hem in stockinette because I had knit several inches when I first cast on and it just all rolled up on itself. I was worried about having enough yarn for the pattern and I didn't want a lot of my yarn to be lost on this hem that was just rolling up on itself. So I ripped that out and cast on again with a tubular cast on and about an inch of ribbing, and the hem sits very nice at the waist, at the low waist. And then there's just a lot of knitting in the round in stockinette, which makes this a great on-the-go project. The lace instructions are incredibly clear and quite simple, but for a really flattering effect. The lace inset grows as you knit it, and sometimes it can be quite drapey. When I looked at a review of the finished projects on Ravelry, I wasn't pleased with the amount of drape that some knitters had in the neckline. I wanted something that would stay a little more firm, I guess, across the neckline. And so I did not do some of the increases. I omitted some of the increases, and I didn't use a stretchy bind-off. I used a regular bind-off. I also used a crochet technique to join the tops of the shoulders. I think that this gives a much sturdier seam than just threading a needle and sewing the seams closed. It's also much easier when you use a crochet seam to rip it out and redo it if you wanted to add a little bit more length to the garment before you seamed it up, for example. It's much easier to rip out a crochet seam than it is to unpick every stitch of a sewn seam. And the yarn is so light and so delicate that it doesn't create a bunchy or very visible seam at the top of the shoulder. This top is beautiful, but it also is quite demure. And I like that it comes all the way to the edge of the shoulder. There's no sleeve on this tank, but it's not skimpy either. There's really nice coverage from the edge of the shoulder into the neckline. And it's an incredibly flattering silhouette without any shaping. So I think this is going to be a really staple piece in my summer wardrobe. And I am already thinking about casting on another because I think it's so versatile and it can be worn on its own as well as under a blazer or a jacket. Once again, that's Bonnie, a sleeveless tank with a lace insert at the neck, designed by Tin Can Knits. The front porch. Recently, I've cast on a few new projects as well. Finally, I've cast on the Agatha socks. This is a pattern designed by Claire of the New Hampshire Knits podcast, and it's one that's gained quite a bit of traction for Claire, so it's very exciting. And she made a gift of this pattern to me quite a while ago when it first came out. But I wanted to get some other socks completed and brush up on my sock making skills before I attempted this pattern. I think I've done that successfully, and I've cast on four Agatha socks. They're named after Agatha, one of the family chickens, and Agatha has a mind of her own. She doesn't always like to stay where she's supposed to be. So the beautiful lattice pattern on the socks is reminiscent of Agatha escaping her pen. I decided to use the very last of my yarn from the Super Summer Knit Together I attended in summer of 2014. This is yarn I purchased from Laura of Jinx Yarns. It's a Blueface Lester sock. It's superwash merino, 100% Blueface Lester. Really nice high twist yarn. It's a beautiful chalky turquoise color, and the color name is Sea Salt Ice Cream, which I thought would be great for warm weather knitting, even though we haven't had any warm weather yet. So I cast on, I completed the beautiful cuff, which is a twisted rib cuff, and then I have knit almost all of the lattice cuff of the first sock. And I'm nearly ready to turn the heel. I'm knitting these on US size 0 needles, double pointed needles, carbons, and I'm enjoying the knitting very much. I feel like I'm a more confident sock knitter, and I also feel like handling the carbons needles is very comfortable. Claire's pattern is also extremely well written, and I'm enjoying that too. The other cast on that I've done over the past few weeks is Paper Cranes. This is a pattern by Lori Versace, and I'm knitting it in Swan's Island Fingering in the indigo color. This yarn I've washed over 7 times. Still, when I'm knitting with it, there is some blue on my fingers as I'm knitting. I really thought that I had all of that indigo washed out of there, but apparently not. I do like the hand of the yarn, but the leftover blue residue is more than a little irritating. I'm knitting this shawl on US size 4 needles, and this is a great pattern for on-the-go knitting because the majority of it is just ribbing and stockinette. And then there are these beautiful paper cranes, and the paper crane stitch is just a variety of yarn over stitch to make an opening in the fabric. And the number of openings in the fabric increases as the shawl increases, and it also gets wider as you knit. So it's sort of an asymmetrical stole shape. I think having this in blue will be great for warm weather. It has kind of a denim look to it, and it will be really nice for less formal occasions, I think. The Paper Cranes shawl is part of a 2-shawl knit along that's been going on since March and will continue until the end of June. So far, 2 intrepid knitters have decided to join me, and they've both made really nice posts on Ravelry. So I'm going to tell you about their projects, and they also raise some interesting points. Jacqueline Salem is knitting the Hedy Yee shawl by Isolde Teague. She's knitting it in beautiful Brooklyn tweed shelter. And the color she's using for her cabled border is Hayloft. The cables look incredible. I actually witnessed Jacqueline casting on for this shawl. And she writes that this 8-row repeat of the cabled border is super quick and super addicting. She's about, I assume she's well over half of the way through that first chart. And she wants a very large shawl, so Jacqueline will be knitting another 10 extra repeats. And I think one of the things that makes this pattern so great is that it is easily customizable. If you want a larger shawl, you just knit more repeats of the cabled border, and then you have a wider expanse and a deeper shawl as well. Stax, who is Jan, has decided to knit paper cranes, and she's using a Louette Kidlin lace weight in a lovely mellow yellow, she says. It's discontinued. I'm interested in seeing this yarn because I've never heard of Louette Kidlin lace weight. But she writes a little bit in her post about her method she has, or her biorhythm, for working on knitting projects. And she invites other people to share a little bit about how they manage their fiber habits. So she addresses a difficult pattern right after coffee. She has something that doesn't take as much brain power for later in the evening. And then she has sewing projects ready for when she has a big chunk of time and she can manage something like that. She also talks about where she keeps her projects so that they're accessible and they are ready at the time when she is ready for them. So what about you? Do you have some fiber biorhythms that help you manage your projects, especially if you are engaged in several different types of crafting? Maybe you've developed some methods for when you work on what. I'm a bit haphazard, which could be one of the reasons for the amount of productivity that I have. I tend to have a project always with me, and now that I'm a more accomplished sock knitter, I will put a sock project into my bag for on the go. I also have a small box of spindling, and I always have it with me, And often I engage in a bit of meditative spindling at some point during the day. In this metal box is my Jenkins Cuchulu spindle. It's very, very small. And then a bit of fiber. I just spin a little bit at a time, and I will often ply that yarn as well, since it comes off in a centripole ball. And then I ply it, and I make little skeins of yarn. Sometimes this is enough yarn for a small project like a bird of happiness, but I have yet to decide on the project that would really be ideal for all of these little bits of yarn. And I really don't think a sock blanket is on my horizon. Maybe someday, but it's just not a project that interests me right now. So I store them up, and then, you know, I use these little bits for ornaments. Sometimes I send them to friends, or if I'm doing a swap package, I might put one of my little skeins of hand spun in there. What other people do with them, I have no idea. Maybe they're working on sock blankets. I'm not sure. But it can just be a nice memento, even just to have a little bit of someone's hand spun, I think. Other larger projects I keep in an ottoman that I have where I sit on the sofa. And I also have knitting tools in there and knitting reference books as well. And that's a great thing to pull out when I'm sitting on the couch or when I'm going to work on something uninterrupted. My wheel, my spinning wheel, kind of moves all around the house. In warmer months, I like to have it downstairs so that I can haul it out onto the porch whenever possible. And I find that sitting on the porch in warm weather is when I get the most productive spinning done. And like Jan, I try to prep sewing projects and then work on them when I have a larger chunk of time, or when I know I can work on something day after day in the afternoon or evening. I still find it very difficult to adopt a craft for 20 method for sewing. I think for spinning, maybe even for knitting or embroidery, that might be possible. But for me, sewing, I feel like 2 hours is what I need to be able to settle into some work on a sewing project. What about you? Let's answer Jan and talk about how we manage our projects and manage our time. I'm sure she would love to hear your ideas. Ever-expanding skill set. This month, the month of May, the ingredient for hashtag Power Pantry is rhubarb. And it's generated quite a bit of excitement among Yarns at Yinhu listeners. Several folks have already posted that they're really excited about cooking with rhubarb. It's one of their favorites. Of course, if you don't have rhubarb local to you, or it's not an ingredient that interests you, you can always feel free to adopt the hashtag Power Pantry stance with any ingredient you like. Just choose an ingredient and make a plan to continue cooking with that ingredient throughout the month, trying some different things, maybe doing a bit of research, sharing recipe ideas with others, and trying to expand your skill set. That's what we're all about, expanding our skill set so that you have a larger number of skills, ideas, techniques, recipes at your disposal. Rhubarb is fascinating to me. I've grown up with rhubarb. My mother always has had some in her garden, and I've never really thought too much about it. I recall when reading Animal Vegetable Miracle by Barbara Kingsolver, which is one of my favorite food books, that her daughter was really eager for fresh fruit in the spring. And the whole story of Animal Vegetable Miracle is that the family had agreed that they would eat locally for 1 year and they would be really judicious about their choices. So it's early spring. Of course, the only fruit in the market is imported. And she's trying to find something that will satisfy her daughter's cravings. And she comes back with rhubarb. So even though rhubarb is a vegetable, many people treat it like a fruit because it's tart and it's often used in desserts and pastries. People will treat it like a fruit. It has a refreshing quality like a fruit. And this month, I will be cooking with rhubarb. In fact, today, when I visit my mother for Mother's Day, I will be cutting some rhubarb and taking it home to experiment. Rhubarb also freezes very well. So I have a bag of frozen rhubarb from last season in my freezer. On the web, I found a site, which I will link to in the show notes on yarns@yinhu.com, called the Rhubarb Compendium, More Than You Ever Wanted to Know About Rhubarb. And this really is quite a complete website and fascinating. So I'll share a little bit about the botanical information. Rhubarb is a plant name for one of the many different species of rheum. It grows wild in the mountains of the western and northwestern provinces of China and in the adjoining Tibetan territory, and in cultivation in much of Europe and the United States. It's a rhizome. It originated in Asia over 2,000 years ago. It was initially cultivated for medicinal qualities. Many folks still use rhubarb for medicinal purposes. It's a perennial, so if you maintain a rhubarb patch well, most folks will have rhubarb from early spring through the summer. The stalks get woodier and less appealing as the summer goes on, and they also will fail to yield if they get too crowded. It's important to keep in mind that only the stalk of the rhubarb plant is edible, not the leaves. The leaves, however, I've learned since taking the sheep to shawl course, the leaves are a very traditional basis for a mordant. It needs to be made very carefully in a well-ventilated area because I think some toxic fumes or gases can come off if you're cooking down the leaves in a space that isn't ventilated. But I would like to give this a try to make some mordant with rhubarb leaves. It says that a pound of leaves can create enough mordant for several pounds of yarn or fiber. That interests me, so I'm going to check that out. On this website is also a little bit of rhubarb history and nutrition information. Rhubarb is rich in vitamin C and dietary fiber. I wouldn't say overwhelmingly so, just looking at the numbers in a serving. It seems that the tart and tangy taste is really the appeal of rhubarb to people, not necessarily the nutritional value. The history page has a bit of information about rhubarb in Europe. It says, Marco Polo, who knew all about the Chinese rhubarb rhizome, talked about it at length in the accounts of his travels in China. So much interest on the past of Marco Polo is accounted for by the fact that in those days, Venice was an extremely important trading center, and that as a result of Eastern Arabic influence, Chinese rhubarb was already widely used in European pharmacy, especially in the school of Salerno. The roots of the Chinese type are still used in medicine. It's mentioned several times that the most potent forms of rhubarb and the ones that are most appropriate for medicinal uses are the Chinese varieties that grow in the wild. A planting of rhubarb is recorded in Italy in 1608 and 20 to 30 years later in Northern Europe. In 1778, rhubarb is recorded as a food plant in Europe. The earliest known usage of rhubarb as a food appearing as a filling for tarts and pies. Some suspect that this was a hybrid of the Chinese variety of rhubarb. About 1777, Hayward, an apothecary of Banbury in Oxfordshire, commenced the cultivation of rhubarb with other plants raised from seeds sent from Russia in 1762, and produced a drug of excellent quality, which was used to be sold as the genuine rhubarb by men dressed up as Turks. When Hayward died, he left his rhubarb plantations to the ancestor of the present cultivators of the rhubarb fields at Banbury, and it's still cultivated there. Rhubarb in America. Early records of rhubarb in America identify an unnamed Maine gardener as having obtained seed or root stock from Europe in the period between 1790 and 1800. He introduced it to the growers in Massachusetts, where its popularity spread, and by 1822, it was sold in produce markets. Since I'm already quite familiar with using rhubarb in pies, I'd like to expand my skill set by maybe making an infusion of rhubarb for some fizzy drinks. Also, rhubarb in savory recipes. On the Food 52 website, I saw a recipe for a rhubarb citrus chicken. Rhubarb also makes a great compote or chutney, and that is good for serving with a food like pork, perhaps. Something that is great with a sweet and tangy sauce or accompaniment. And since I'm quite familiar with rhubarb in pies, I'm thinking of trying it in some other desserts. And there are quite a few recipes for an upside down cake or a variety of upside down cake, where there's rhubarb and other ingredients in the bottom of the pan, sometimes a baking pan, and I even saw one for a cast iron skillet, and then a cake batter is poured on top of that. The cake is baked upside down, hence the upside down cake in the title, and then the entire thing is inverted to serve so that you have a cake on the bottom and then usually some sort of sweet, maybe a little bit of oozing topping over the top of it. And that's a great tradition. It's often done with pineapple. You hear of pineapple upside down cake, but there are some varieties with rhubarb that seem very interesting to me. I've also seen rhubarb as an ingredient in scones, which could be interesting to try. So I look forward to cooking along with you. Hashtag Power Pantry. The month of May is all about rhubarb. And so forth. May is known on social media as hashtag MeMadeMay for many crafters and makers. And it seems especially popular with folks who are working on a handmade wardrobe. Some of them try to wear a handcrafted item every day during the month of May. Some even go so far as to take photographs of themselves in completely handmade outfits. This can be very inspiring or very dispiriting, depending on your attitude and your feeling about where you are on your own journey of making. For me, it's year two of my goal of a mostly handmade wardrobe in 5 years. And over the course of this first year and more, I've really adjusted my notions of what a mostly handmade wardrobe means. I think when I started on the journey, I thought that I would just start making all of the things that I typically like to wear. But my skill set really isn't ready for that, and I need to make a lot of very simple things. And that's supplemented with machine-made things that are already in my wardrobe. I've also come to terms with the fact that a mostly handmade wardrobe is likely to mean less pieces, less in my closet than it was when I was, you know, wearing more commercially made things. And I've also been reluctant to just ditch favorite pieces in my wardrobe because they're not handmade. I have some pieces that I really enjoy wearing and that, you know, I saved a lot of money to buy, or I thought very carefully about my purchase. And so, you know, I'm not going to let go of those things so easily. And it can be dispiriting to see that other people are so advanced in their journey of making, and they, you know, have a beautiful outfit that they've made themselves, and that I'm just at the beginning of that process. But on good days, it can be very inspiring to see how much people care about making their own things and what they've learned about their journey. And they, you know, may snap a photo and put something up on social media and it seems so simple, but I know that that was a huge investment of their time and energy and thoughtfulness, and that just because they may have a greater quantity of things, it doesn't mean that the journey isn't as significant for them. So I've tried in my year of balance, you know, to do less of comparing and more of celebrating the incremental skill building that I have made. And during this month of May, kind of unplanned, I've been able to advance a little bit in my own crafting to doing something that I hadn't really expected. It just occurred to me on Monday that I might try to do it, and I enlisted Samuel's help, and it's come out to be a success. I've had a skirt, a store-bought skirt from Anthropologie, for maybe 10 or more years. It's a favorite wrap skirt in black linen. It's a staple piece in my wardrobe, and it's a really unusual design. And since I've been sewing, I've laid this skirt out and looked at it many times to think about how it was made and pieced together. It's made of 4 very large and irregularly shaped pieces of fabric. There's a pocket and a really simple tie. The tie passes through the skirt. There's 1 loop on the back. And I love the versatility of the skirt. And I thought that I would trace the pieces without dismantling it. I would trace the pieces, create my own pattern, and then see about making a version of this in a deep plum color in a linen cotton blend. So with Samuel's assistance, I managed to trace all of the pieces of the skirt. And this was really important because I didn't have enough hands to manipulate the paper and the tracing and the skirt all at once. Then I used some very simple rulers and other tools to add a 5/8 inch seam allowance to the sides and the hemline of each pattern piece after I traced it. And before I cut it out, I just put the skirt on top of the pattern pieces again and made a few adjustments as I saw fit. I spent a lot of time looking at the grain line of each piece of the pattern and marking a long parallel line on the pattern piece to indicate the grain line. And then I was very pleased to find that all of these pattern pieces fit on, I think it was 2.25 yards of fabric, which is great because the last wrap skirt I made took nearly 4 yards of fabric. So this is an incredible savings if I'm thinking about, you know, the cost of yards of fabric. I placed the pattern pieces, cut them out, and all of this time I was working just a few hours each evening all week long. So definitely not a craft for 20, but pacing my work out and working on a project continually over a period of several days. I used a variety of a flat felled seam to sew the four pieces of the pattern together. Really, my variety is, I guess it's sort of an inside out flat felt seam. A flat felt seam is the type of seam you often find on the side seams of your jeans, where there's like a folded piece and actually two lines of sewn stitches that you see on the outside of the jeans. To accomplish this with the skirt, I first sewed wrong sides together, and then I trimmed off the excess fabric, and then I sewed right sides together, and this accomplished a French seam. And the bulk of that French seam was on the inside of the garment. Then I pressed that seam flat and added another line of stitching so that the French seam was flattened inside the garment. In the future, I might attempt using a flat felt seam that appears on the outside of the fabric. I'm not sure. And I looked at some directions for a flat felt seam because Emily of Fibertown was mentioning it when we were talking yesterday, and I had never heard of that term. So I looked it up, and it seems like a traditional flat felt seam is accomplished in a little bit of a different technique. So I might try that in the future. But essentially, this is a French seam with an additional line of stitching so that it's flattened on the inside of the garment and has a lot less bulk that way. So I attached those four pieces together, and then I used a piece of, it's not bias tape, it's just a flat tape with a double fold that I used for the waistband of the garment. And I think I improved on the original with this because I found that the original wrap skirt has a rather flimsy waist tie. It's only about half an inch in width, and mine is nearly an inch, so it has a little bit more structure to it. And I attached that and made sure that there was enough on each end so that the garment could be tied. I let the skirt hang for 24 hours before I sewed the hemline. And I did need to make a couple of cuts and adjustment of excess fabric along the hem because my pattern pieces didn't align quite so perfectly on the bottom of the skirt. But I was able to just trim off the excess, and I just hemmed the skirt with a folded hem. And then I added a buttonhole opening so that the waistband could pass through the skirt. And I had added a little loop at the back so that the waistband could pass through before I tied it. This skirt fits just as well as the original. I did not add the pocket. I'm not sure if I will add the pocket, but I definitely have enough fabric to do that. And I can envision making additional versions of this skirt all summer long. Its drape is beautiful. It has really nice coverage. So even though it's a wrap skirt, it's not flying open at every opportunity. It's, you know, rather demure. And it has a really nice length to it. So I could even see shortening this skirt for more of a work skirt version that's a little more free-flowing. And I feel really accomplished with this piece. Like, it's a truly a step in the making of my handmade wardrobe. It was a great thrill to wear it yesterday for the Maryland Sheep and Wool Festival. And I think the color and the design are pretty versatile so that it's a wardrobe staple. Wherever you are in your journey of making, I wish you a very happy Me Made May. And I look forward to checking out some of the hashtags during this month and looking for sources of inspiration every day of May.
Acorns are dropping off my Jenny's house. Two ducks in my spyglass, flowery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, I hope you will consider leaving a star rating or a review on iTunes, or liking the show's Facebook page, or joining the Yarns at Yinhu group on Ravelry. The music for the episode is Sweet, music and lyrics by Samuel St. Thomas, performed by Krista Long and Cesar Diaz. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set this week.
Sycamore trees are blazing like a rainbow fire, just like Linda Kurtz sings, but I don't know why. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Nature's a get you high till your face is mine. Jump a river naked, hike a country mile. It's a subway nature thing. It's a subway nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature.